I'm Dr. Klein, and I'm one of the consultation liaison psychiatrists here at Jacoby, and I was asked to give a lecture on how to manage psychiatric patients on the medical service. Okay, so let me just put a question out to the peanut gallery. How do you think we should handle psychiatric patients on the medical service? What would make sense, just from a system standpoint? Anybody? Aside from kill them or get them off to psych. That would be probably the honest answer if anyone was brave enough to give it. What? Put them all in one-to-one. Yeah, anything else?
Held all PRNs.
Okay, let me just make a list of this. One-to-one for everybody. And held all PRN.
Treat their acute medical problems first.
Yeah, that's a big one. I like that. Who said that? Yeah, wow. You're in the minority, unfortunately. Acute med problems first. Anything else?
The question is how to hold psychiatric patients on medical service?
How to treat them. That's the topic of discussion. What was your question? How to hold?
My question is...
Yeah.
I really didn't get the question. That's my question.
Okay. I'm supposed to be talking today about how to treat psychiatric patients on the medical service. That's the question.
You mean their psychiatric problems? If they're admitted with a medical problem.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Big problem.
And why is that?
Yeah, pretty good.
If their psychiatric problems are stable, then yeah. Keep them on the same doses of their psychiatric medications.
Okay.
If there are no medical contraindications to them.
Right, okay. Now, you're asking me or telling me?
Telling me.
Okay. Now, I'm just curious because that's usually what I would do, but how do you arrive at that? Because it's kind of a trick question, but... How do you come up to that conclusion? Like, how do you know they're stable? How do you know what their current dosages are of their meds?
One way is if they have a list or if they bring the pill boxes.
Right, that's one way. Sometimes you're not so lucky. But
call the psychiatrist if they know the name of the psychiatrist.
That is the biggest issue which I have. Which maybe would be the take-home message for today. Yeah. I think just as you treat any medical patient on a medical service and you want to do your due diligence and get history from the treating people, you have to do exactly the same thing for psychiatric patients. Because for me, that's the key for managing any psychiatric patient on a medical floor or on psychiatry. You know, I mean, you have to see where someone left off and what's been going on to know where you're at, you know, because like I get all these consult requests for like treat them, they look depressed, or, you know, treat them, they're off, or I don't know, they look funny. I mean, I get all these like questions, but it's like, you know, usually the simplest thing is just to go back to where they came from and what their history is and what people have been doing for them, you know, not to upset the apple cart and also to set things straight in terms of continuity of care later, because 99 times out of 100, if you are an outpatient psychiatrist or any outpatient practitioner and, you know, your patient goes to hospital, they're going to come back to you, and then what do you do? And most of the time, you don't even know what was done for them in the hospital setting because no one's laying you in on the big secret, you know. A discharge summary oftentimes doesn't really give you all that much working information to do anything. You don't know what transpired, and you don't know what regimen they had them on and why they even did what they did, if they made any changes, you know. So, I mean, that should be really the take-home message. Is to call the psychiatrist or the practitioner or the one who's been prescribing as though they thought they were a psychiatrist and see what's been going on and see what they've been giving them. Clear idea where they're at and where they think they're at so that you know what to do when you pick it up, you know. I think that's the key to this lecture, okay? Because, you know, one-to-one for everybody, like this guy said who was on his phone call, is great as a holding pattern, because like you don't know the person, so it's always easy, you know, just put on one-to-one. That's like most people frankly don't need one-to-one. Just because they're labeled with some psychiatric stuff doesn't mean that they need somebody watching them. And really the only indication is if they're psychotic and if they have some history of agitation, or you know, maybe they need a medical one-to-one for safety issues, that they're at a fall risk, or you know, that they get confused and they wander and stuff like that. But you know, one-to-one costs, I think, about probably maybe $300 a shift. Maybe it must cost like $600 to $900 a day to pay someone just to sit and babysit someone, and the hospital loses tremendous amounts of money for that, because I mean maybe they only get paid, you know, $1,500 for the whole stay, and you're putting it into somebody who's probably half asleep anyway, who's supposed to be watching them, and you're not even sure they're really doing what they're supposed to be doing.
You're supposed to do it on people from wrong state now, right?
I would imagine, yeah. That's fine. I mean, it used to be that Bronx State had a policy that they would have their own one-to-one people come and sit with the patients, but because of budget cuts and things, they held off on that. So then they dump it on us to have to take care of it. And you know, generally people from Bronx State are pretty chronic patients. You know, on that note. One other good thing to do in terms of discerning what their care is and stuff is try to very diligently try to see where these people come from. Because, you know, like everyone says, okay, they came from Bronx State. I see maybe about a third of the patients, if not more, who supposedly come from Bronx State actually come from the TLR, the Transitional Living Services residents. And they still put down the same address, you know, 1500 Waters Place and all like that. TLR, just for those who don't know, is basically like a shelter for patients with psychiatric problems, which is on the grounds of Bronx State. But it's not part of Bronx State, and it's not part of the hospital. So from a follow-up standpoint, if I get someone from TLR, I really have to find out who their psychiatrist is, because I can't just like call up Bronx State and ask like what unit are they from and what they're on. Usually they're followed by someone in some outpatient clinic or in some day program or something. And that's it makes it hard even to figure out what to do for them, because we don't even know where they come from. Also, patients from Bronx State are always going to be treated as bounce backs to Bronx State once they're medically treated. People from TLR, you have to call up TLR, make arrangements, and tell them that they're, you know, medically stable so they can go back. And they won't know if they're, you know, ready psychiatrically, if they're willing to take them back unless they can handle it. My guess is that they don't really have much in the way of medical or nursing resources there even to handle things if they do make any changes. So they have to pretty much be, you know, rock hard stable when they go back, so if they're not going to decompensate and come back to the ER again.
So the major problem is, unlike medical patients, many of our medical patients, they follow up in the clinic, and you can see what's been going on in the clinic.
Right.
The psych follows almost never in the clinic. Very few patients actually follow up around here, and even then, it's hard to figure out where their notes are.
Right.
Or most of them, they have, based on their catchment area, they may follow elsewhere, but they keep coming back to the hospital, and there's... And the very reason that sends them to the psychiatrist usually prevents them from telling us who the psychiatrist is or what they're on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So then it's very hard for us. I don't know if there's any other, if you have any other tricks up your sleeve to figure out who.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, these are the basic things that I have to do, you know, so these are things that you could just as easily do and should do. You have to see if these people have family. Because family, whatever it is, at least those are supposed to be patient supports, and they're supposed to know more about what's going on with the patient and where they are and, you know, what they're doing. And they're usually a big source. If you don't have any family, that could be a problem. The next thing you do is look on the computerized report, and if they've been there before, look at the social work notes, because sometimes you get real pearls of information from there, because someone actually did like a psychosocial assessment, and they kind of see who the significant players are in the person's life and who their, you know, supports are and where they go for outpatient stuff and everything. It's all there generally in the chart if you look hard enough for it. And I know it's a pain in the ass, and it's a pain in the ass for me to have to look for it also, but this is life. You know, you guys have to, like, do it. I mean, if you have a cardiology patient who has hypertension, I mean, you wouldn't think twice about calling their cardiologist just in the community or their GP and try to get some history of like where they're at, because now they came in like this, and is this the baseline or this is something new, or you know, they're non-compliant or what have you. So it's the same thing. So you know, if you're lucky enough to have a frequent flyer, sometimes that will be a wealth of information. The other thing is, if you look in the consults themselves, if they've been seen by psych already, you can look in the consults and see what the psychiatrist maybe came up with them before, and then see, you know, what happened since or what was going on before, and get some history, you know? So, I mean, aside from that, a lot of patients might have caseworkers, and you can sometimes see if you can access who the caseworker is, or if someone is followed by the ACT team. That's another big source, because the ACT team should be following these people, and you just call up the psych emergency room at 4850 and ask to speak with the ACT team, and they might have some history of them on their chart. And I think there's a way that they can access to know if they're on other people's teams, because a lot of the hospitals in the Bronx have their own ACT teams and they keep track of them, you know. And the caseworker at least is one person that should be like overseeing their care and making sure that things are getting done.
What is the ACT team?
The ACT team, I forget actually what the acronym is for what it represents, but basically what it is a follow-up psychiatric care in the community. That these are people who maybe live at home, they have histories of non-compliance, they don't go to outpatient appointments, they might be court mandated to have to go for some sort of psych follow-up because they failed numerous times, and that's why they end up in the hospital many times. And in order to stop, you know, kind of like ridiculous hospitalizations, people come in, you know, 6-8 times because they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing out in the community, and then they bounce back, an ACT team was, you know, provided to follow up, you know. And what they do is they generally make home visits, and they might see patients in the community once or twice a week, or even more so if need be. They also might be dispensing the meds, like, so if people are on depot neuroleptics like Haldol or Prolixin or Risperdal Consta or something like that, they're the ones that give them the shot, and at least we make sure that they get medicated out in the community, so at least they get their meds once a month, and then that's a way to cut down on psych hospitalization, so people don't decompensate that much, that maybe they can be managed as outpatients in the community. So that's the ACT team. What else? Haldol PRNs. You brought up Haldol PRNs. I might as well bring that up. Okay. Haldol is an excellent drug, but it has to be used, I guess, judiciously, because you could have problems with it. I mean, this is a prejudice I have, but I'll say it. You know, surgeons are usually very, very freewheeling with Haldol. So, like, more so than the medical internal medicine people. So, you know, it's not unusual for me to get called to see some patient on surgery, and you know, they're agitated, or they had some history, and they say, well, I put them a Q4 of Haldol PRN, you know. And so you get these people, like, you know, they got already like 30 milligrams of Haldol in a day or two, and then they're still agitated and they're confused or they're zonked, and then now they're wondering why they seem to have a change of mental status, you know. But you know, it's kind of comical, but it's serious also, because Haldol itself is not a benign drug. It's a very, very useful drug, probably because it's the most, probably the best studied of all the neuroleptics, maybe next to Thorazine. I mean, it's been around for such a long time, and I think it's there's a reason for it, because I think it works very well if you know how to use it, and you know you give it judiciously. My experience has been that Haldol works better at low dosages for people with agitation, and especially with delirium, than they work in high dosages. Okay, in part that's because Haldol still is anticholinergic, and it has anticholinergic properties. So if you have someone who's already confused, if you give them too much of something which might add to their confusion, they're probably going to get worse, not going to get better. And so if you give them a half a milligram of Haldol or 1 milligram of Haldol, maybe every 6 hours as a PRN, that might do a lot better than giving them the 5. The other thing you worry about is that with African Americans, especially young African Americans, you have a higher risk of dystonic reactions, acute dystonias. So if you give some, you know, a guy who's 23, 5 milligrams of Haldol, and he's never been on it before, you know, he might have a really scary reaction, and that's an acute thing. I mean, you get like epistatonis, you know, and your whole spine curves. You look up, you can't look down. Your head goes back. Your eyeballs kind of go back, you know, in your head. You're like looking like this. It gets to be hard to breathe. You can feel like your trach is like really getting kind of like cut off, and it's, you know, becomes like a psychiatric emergency. And it's also really, really scary because there's not much you can do about it. I mean, a person doesn't know what hit them when that happens. Treatment of choice, if you ever see someone like that actually having that, is a Benadryl, which you can give IV push through a butterfly needle, and it works like magic. It's a very, very dramatic thing. If you ever have a chance to do it, it's great. Like, as soon as you have the needle in and you push it, it pretty much like breaks, you know. And so, you know, but if you're at the receiving end of it and you have a dystonic reaction, people will be really scared and will never want to be on any psychiatric medications, even if they're going to be helpful, because they're afraid that's going to happen again. So as it goes with Haldol, my caveat is that you should only be giving it in small amounts and, gingerly. You can always give more of a medicine, but you can't really take it away, you know, once you give it, you know. I mean, like if you're a cook, I don't know if anyone knows about cooking, so if you like put too much salt in something, you can put a potato in and it'll absorb the salt and, like, you know, it'll save your cooking day. You can't really do that with Haldol. And one of the big problems, like, even with the depot neuroleptics, is if you have someone, like, with a neuroleptic malignant syndrome, and you're giving them, you know, depot Haldol, it's going to take a long time for it to get out of your system. So you really have to make sure someone's really responding to it and it works well for them before you start down that road, because you're not going to be able to just stop it. Even if you stop it, you can wait, you know, 4 weeks until it gets out of your system. Okay. Someone mentioned about treating the acute medical problem. Okay. So, you know, like when I get a consult request, I usually have to separate what the medical problem is from the psychiatric problem. Sometimes they're one and the same, and just no one knows it. And then sometimes they're two separate issues, because I find that doctors have a tremendous amount of anxiety about dealing with someone with psychiatric illness. There's tremendous stigma attached to someone having a psych diagnosis, and people are generally very afraid of these patients, especially patients from Bronx State, I guess, because, you know, they're really chronic, and so then you think they're really aggressive and all like that. Usually, it's a very, very small percentage of people who come from psychiatric hospitals who are really agitated and really dangerous. You do get some here, but it's not the majority. So you really have to go on a case-by-case basis and just try to really assess how the person is. When you see the patient, try to see if they even understand why they're in the hospital and see if they have any understanding of what's going on, if they want help, if they don't want help. And that at least will be a way to sort of foresee who you're dealing with and see how they're going to be. Because if you have like a hands-off attitude and say, well, you know, they're psych and they're dangerous, whatever, they could probably feel it too, that they're being avoided. And unfortunately, I mean, I think it's pretty easy to document. I mean, I'm sure there have been papers written about already, you know, that psychiatric patients in the hospital and ER settings get the worst care, and they actually have the worst morbidity and mortality than general medical patients, because they're usually pushed off to the side. So someone who comes in with schizophrenia and chest pain, usually when they see them in the ER, the first thing they're hearing is that they have schizophrenia. So they put them on a lower tier because they're thinking that's really the primary problem, and then they really came in for chest pain, and so that's kind of on the back burner. So by the time they get to them, they might have already had a really big infarct, or you know, they're having more distress, and you know this could have been really addressed sooner, but you know, again, the label gets in the way, and they get shortchanged. And I think that's no different than when they get on medical floors also, because everyone's comfortable with treating hypertension, but they're not comfortable with treating someone with schizophrenia, you know. Again, I guess that's the reason why it's good to try to go back to whoever the treating person is and get some history of what someone's regimen is, you know. I guess... one thing I want to touch on was the treatment of agitation. I mean, this seems like to come up repeatedly, you know. And I guess part of this is a diagnostic dilemma. When someone has a history of a psychiatric illness and they're agitated, you always really have to look at the question of whether a person has delirium or not in the context of coming into the hospital. Because when someone is medically compromised and has things going on, it's not hard for someone with a kind of an impaired neurological system to go off and become confused and agitated already. And a lot of times the people I get called to see who they say are depressed are actually delirious. And so you really have to look very carefully at the medical stuff, what's going on. Look at the electrolytes, look at the meds that people are on, look if there's any signs or symptoms of an infectious process, and whether this is an acute change or different than what the usual is. I mean, because that's basically what I do. I'm just troubleshooting whatever comes in the door, you know. If anyone has any questions or comments, please let me know, because we got, like, I guess a few minutes. I don't know how long this generally goes. Does it go to 1:30? Okay. So we got a half hour. Maybe I'll make it more interesting for you also, because I know people always have, like, practical questions about things with medication and what to do with psych meds, because there's a lot to know. But it's pretty simple if you look at it from a systems kind of standpoint, you know? I mean, one thing I do like to do is continue someone's meds as they came in until, unless there's a reason to do otherwise. Like, someone comes in with lithium toxicity, and they have, you know, lithium level 1.8, and maybe, you know, you're supposed to have up to like 1.2 or 1.5 tops. Well, I'm not going to just continue the lithium willy-nilly, because I know, you know, that's what's part of the problem. But, you know, in general, If someone seems to be doing okay, you know, why, you know, if it's not broken, why fix it? And then you could always adjust something after that, you know.
What's the treatment of choice for a patient that comes that has long-term dementia, he comes to the floors and becomes agitated, like, trying to pull out the IV, pulling out wandering?
Mm-hmm.
What would you do with that case?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, Unfortunately, treatment of dementia and agitation has become very complicated because of medical legal issues involved with that. It used to be, you know, you give people neuroleptics and it would go away. Then they came out with studies some years back that showed that if you give people who are demented neuroleptics, generally vascular dementias, I'm talking about, people with vascular dementias, and you give them neuroleptics, it might increase their risk of dying sooner than if you didn't use an antipsychotic. So now they have all these health warnings and box warnings and stuff. I know that there was someone, I don't know if anyone has this guy, Diaz. Okay, yeah. So you've been calling, your medical student called, I know, whatever. Whatever. I just saw him actually before I came here. Okay. So just to explain the case a little bit. I mean, I think the guy is like in his 70s. 62, Hispanic guy. He was seen by a psychiatrist at NCB, Dr. Scher, who's actually a geriatric psychiatrist, and he said that he's demented. And I think he came in on like Tegretol and Geodon when he saw him in January, and then he went back to a nursing home, and it's kind of like God knows what happened since January now. So I mean, I guess you call the nursing home, and they don't even. Excuse me, know if he's even being seen by a psychiatrist, even though they have to be if they have on any neuroleptics. Generally, you know, they have a psychiatrist pretty much in every nursing home around because it's pretty common business. Everyone's looking for nursing homes that can work. So then he had a bit of a tremor. And I think I had recommended, I saw him on a small amount of Zyprexa. And I think the question came up, like Neuro said, well, he has a tremor, so we should take him off of everything. But now he's like talking about he wants to be dead. He's dead already. You know. Well, I mean, once you start talking like that, it seems like this is not a good time to take someone off psychotropic meds. You know, I saw him now. It looks like he's electively mute. I mean, he understands what you say, and he just doesn't want to talk. And I don't know if he's psychotic or he's depressed or what. Can't tell you. But, not a good time to stop the neuroleptics. It's only going to make it worse. For people with dementia and Parkinson's, they say that the best neuroleptic to use is Seroquel. That's supposed to be the best neuroleptic to use for anyone with really a movement disorder. So if they have sensitivity to neuroleptics like EPS, or they have tardive dyskinesia or something, Seroquel is supposed to be the drug, you know. I do a few things for people with dementia, with agitation. I might try to use alternate meds, okay, like trazodone. Trazodone, if you give it 25 milligrams twice a day or three times a day, or let's say maybe twice a day with a PRN a couple of times during the day, it takes the edge off. It's a little bit sedating, it's pretty good. In the elderly, we try to really limit, if not just avoid use totally, benzodiazepines, because the elderly can accumulate benzos. They get a high enough blood level. They don't metabolize the things well, and then you know they fall, and then they break their hip, and then you'll be in court being sued because you were the cause of an injury. And a lot of times they'll win. Because they'll say, why do you have someone on benzos? I mean, it used to be, and it still unfortunately is, you'll get people in the community who are 85 years old, and they've been on 20th Valium for 30 years. And you try to get an 80-something year old person off of Valium, they are wedded to the medication. They will not give that up, no way in hell. I mean, it's not going to happen. And if you try lowering it, they will stop you, or they're going to go back and do the same thing. And, sometimes the doctors create these monsters in the community where you have these things where they're on benzos, and they love the benzos, and, you're stuck. because once they stop taking them, they're going to withdraw. You're going to have people with withdrawal seizures, and I mean, just like alcohol withdrawal. Or you have elderly people which are drinking and using benzos too. And you really should always be asking elderly patients about their drinking habits, because this is one of the most ignored problems in the community. People don't think that elderly people drink, but they could actually drink a lot. They don't talk about it. And then, you know, then they call a psych consult because, you know, they've been in the hospital like 3 days, and all of a sudden they're agitated, and it's really because they're going through alcohol withdrawal, and, you know, it fits the timeline, you know, like 48 to 72 hours after they had their last drink, that's when they start losing it, and that just so happens to be when they came in, and they probably were drinking, you know, the day before they came into the hospital, and, you know, if you do a blood alcohol level, you're not going to find anything if they had been drinking the day before, because it would have been out of their system already. So it's also a good idea to try to do tox screens pretty much at anyone who walks in the door if you think there's even the slightest suspicion that someone's been abusing drugs or alcohol or might be, because at least they'll give you a timeline to know what you're dealing with. And like if you watch House, he says everyone lies. That's one of the big things they lie about. And especially substance abusers, they say, no, I haven't used for weeks. And then, sure enough, the tox screen shows a positive for cocaine. And then you present it to them, and they said, no, can't be. And it's like, no, it's definitely. That's it, you know. And they'll lie right to your face. But and they seem very convincing, but, you know, it's not probably lab error. You can repeat it if you want, but, you know, it is what it is. So the trazodone is something I usually try to go with a PRN, or the smallest amount of neuroleptic I can use, you know. So if I could use, let's say, 12.5 of Seroquel at maybe at bedtime, like one dose, so at least you get something into them, so you don't have to worry about PRNing them and waiting for the nurse to decide that someone needs something. At least you get a little touch of it that might help them with their sleep, because it's sedating, and you'll get something into their system. And you could stop it. I mean, it's not a big deal to, you know, discontinue it. With that said, though, make sure if you have anyone on a neuroleptic not to continue the neuroleptic on discharge, unless you know, like the psychiatrist said, they need it. Because that's really a terrible thing when, like, someone's prescribed a neuroleptic and then they just keep on it and then no one knows why they're on it. And then they end up getting tardive dyskinesia because, you know, they've been on it for a while. You see all these, like, commercials for, you know, did you have someone on Regland? You know, this is something that was known years ago, that Reglan causes tardive dyskinesia, because it's the same as a neuroleptic. It works the same, except it doesn't have any psychiatric treating properties, but it's a D2 blocker. And so it causes tardive. So all the GI guys were giving Reglan, like, candy to people if they had nausea or whatever, and people weren't for years, and all of a sudden they start having oral buccal movements, having rabbit like movements, and then a lot of times it doesn't go away. So you have to be, you know, very careful about those meds. You want to ask a question?
Can you actually, like, ask Rob, like, that question about antipsychotics, because we had a patient who was admitted, she's like 9 years old, with dementia. She was admitted to the hospital, well, she was discharged, like, I guess, over a week now, and she was agitated in the hospital, so they put in an olanzapine, and then they didn't stop it, but, you know, she came in on olanzapine. So she's been here for acute pancreatitis, and we stopped on the admission. Now the question was, you know, what to do with that olanzapine. Like, that's the question. Like, she should not have been even, like, discharged home with olanzapine if she just has
agitation.
Yeah. Was last time in the hospital, and this time, you know, there's no agitation whatsoever.
Yeah, and you're also lucky if, well, you don't get sued too, because olanzapine is notorious for giving people adults pancreatitis. So someone could turn around and say it was the Zyprexa that caused it, and then how do you prove them that it didn't happen? It's hard, you know. I mean, you know, you could say, well, if 90 years old, something's going to happen anyway. I mean, you know, if you're not going to die from one thing, you'll die from another. But, like, courts always look for, like, to put blame on someone. Someone has to pay. Someone has to be the cause of something. And it's a terrible system, but just it's the way it is. So that's really another reason why you have to be very careful about discharging someone on neuroleptics. I mean, if they came in on it, that's one thing. And then you can monitor it. And then, you know, make sure you document very carefully that they came in on it, and who gave it to them, and that you spoke with them, and all this stuff. It's a good thing to, you know, to CYA on that regard. Any other questions?
So a little bit unrelated, but which antipsychotics doesn't cause weight gain?
Which ones don't cause weight gain?
Haldol
is pretty good, at least in terms of being like, you know, not causing weight gain. I'm trying to think back. I'd have to look, because I know some of the newer ones that they have, like Geodon and stuff, they might say it's like weight neutral. But then you have, you know, the QRS, elongation problems. And that's why, for me, I'm not a big Geodon fan. I don't think it's so great. Other people who use it in the emergency room like to give it because it comes in IM and they feel it's very good in terms of acute agitation, you know. It's not one of my big drugs of choice. I usually go with the simpler stuff.
What is the generic?
Geodon? What? Zaprazidone. So, and then now they just came out with a new antipsychotic, which I really have to study myself, because someone told me someone came in on Safris, which is a senapine, and that's like a new one now that they're starting to market, and that might actually be one of them that might have a weight component. I mean, you know, it used to be that the typical neuroleptics first of all, they were the only ones you had, so that's you had to deal with that. And everyone said, well, you know, we want to get away from those because of TD. So then they went for the atypicals, okay? And then lo and behold, you have the atypicals, and then everyone has all these metabolic syndromes. Everyone's gaining weight, they're all becoming diabetic or having pancreas problems or whatever. And then they find some of them can have TD anyway. I mean, there's no guarantee you won't get it. You could have neuroleptic malignant syndrome with them too. And so then they do the CATIE study, which was like a federally funded study through Columbia, and they came up with the conclusion that you know you can use the old style neuroleptics and they're cheaper, so just use them, you know, which I kind of think is kind of a farce, because, you know, it seems like, I mean, the same person who was talking about using newer stuff is the one who did the study, Jeff Lieberman at Columbia, to go back to the to Trilofan, and it's just as effective, and, you know, it's pretty safe. But, you know, I think in this era with looking to cut corners, you know, the government is looking to use the cheapest medication so they don't have to spend money, and they're trying to give scientific evidence for that to back that up, so everyone will be on Trilofan, and you'll go back to the old days, because they'll say, well, no one really cares anyway about the mentally ill, and it's cheaper, so just give them something cheap, it works, be done, and then that's it.
What do we do about people who come in from the community? Because we, with non-formulary meds, because our formulary of psych meds in patients is very, very limited.
Mm-hmm.
What, 4 or 5 drugs total that's available? Haldol, Seroquel, Olanzapine,
I think there's more. I mean, like, I know that. I mean, I think Remeron is on formulary.
Lexapro is not.
Lexapro is not. So that's an easy one.
But Lexapro, can we switch it to citalopram?
Yeah. Lexapro and citalopram. If you know about it, what it is, one is the mirror image, the molecule of the other. Okay. But they say that one has probably a greater efficacy at lower doses than the other, like by half. So they'll say, you know, 10 of Lexapro is equal to 20 of Celexa. So if you're in a pinch and, you know, you don't have Lexapro on formulary, if someone comes in on 20 of Lexapro, you can give them 40 of Celexa, and that should really be the equivalent, bioequivalent dose. So you can do that, you know. And Celexa is pretty cheap, and they say that it's also probably the best SSRI to use for people with who are on multiple medications, because it has the least drug-drug interactions, you know. Personally, I've always felt that it's not a great antidepressant, that it gives you sort of like a half-baked result. It sort of works, but it's not as good as the old stuff. I mean, Prozac, I prescribe a lot of Prozac because I guess I feel comfortable with it already. And most people who do psychopharm have their own, you know, meds that they feel comfortable with, and that's what they prescribe. I mean, some psychopharmacologists like to come out with the newest thing. As soon as something comes out, they start prescribing it. And that's great, but I think it also makes for a lot of problems. I mean, it might look cool that, like, you're on the edge, or you're on the cutting edge, and, you know, you're using the newest things, but then try to get it out from a pharmacy. You give someone a prescription for Safras, I'd like to see, you know, how many patients are going to get that in the Bronx. They probably have to go to like 10 pharmacies before they're going to find someone who's going to carry it. And usually the pharmacies have to pay money to keep it in stock, so they have to know that they're going to make something out of it in order to even stock it. So it's not always practical.
What do we do about other medications? Like someone comes in on desvenlafaxine, or should we just call you guys and ask you how to switch them around?
Well, I'd love to know myself how to switch them around. People come in on Pristique, you know. I haven't prescribed Pristique for anyone. I mean, I just think a lot of them are just marketing things. I guess my question would be, how long have they been on the medication, and how long do you think you're going to keep them there in the hospital? I mean, if you have someone who's in the hospital and they're going to be there, you know, one day, and you're going to send them out, do you really need to, you know, continue the meds the one day? Is the world going to come to an end if they miss a dose? Probably not. If it's going to be someone, you know, who's going to be there a week, and, you know, they had a long history of depression, and, you know, when they become non-compliant, they decompensate quickly, whatever, that's a different thing. Usually in those situations, I try to do what's practical. I mean, see, look, does the person have medication in the house? Can someone bring it in? Can pharmacy check it and do that? That's the best way to go about it. Sometimes when people come from group homes or something like that, they're prescribing it there, so they can bring it right from the group home and give it. You know, at least bring it in, bring a small supply, especially like if they're in blister packs and stuff. That's the way they get it when they have it. So you don't have to really worry about it not being the real deal. You know what it is, you know. It takes a little extra work, but it's well worth it, because then you avoid problems down the line. You know, if people are not on the meds they're supposed to be. Like, one I could tell you about is Aricept, okay? That's a medication that people usually ignore as being important. But if someone's been doing well with Aricept to help with memory problems with dementia, once you go off it, even for a couple of days, you're going to see a decline in someone's cognition. And then when you restart it, they're not going to bounce back to where they were before, so they lose the progress. And so that's really bad if someone was actually doing okay. I mean, I see that happens in surgery a lot. You know, people come in for surgery, and like by reflex, everyone just like stops all the medicines that they're in prior to surgery, and then usually what happens is they don't remember to start them back on it because they don't think it's really, excuse me, all that important. It comes to you and they say, I don't know, Uncle John doesn't really seem right, he seems more forgetful and all like that, and sure enough, it's because they stopped the Aricept. And then you can't make up that loss. I mean, maybe they're going to get a little better, but they're never going to be what they were before. So that's a medicine to keep pretty much under any circumstance, is Aricept. Any other medication questions? mood stabilizers, lithium, how to dose it?
We call it expert.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, lithium is not a rocket science medication. I mean, basically, it's a salt, right? So the first thing you should do with anyone who comes in on lithium or Depakote is get a lithium or Depakote, you know, valproic acid level when they come in the morning. So that way, at least you'll know where they're at. You know, I mean, if they're toxic, then you know enough to probably hold the dose or decrease it. If they have nothing on board, then you probably know they haven't been taking it in the first place. So that's a question about whether to restart it or you know, speak with their clinician on the outside and see if that's been an issue. No, but lithium is actually a very, very safe drug if you watch it and monitor it. I mean, the only stuff you have to really be concerned with is, you know, renal problems and thyroid problems. I mean, you know, sometimes you could have, you know, a bradycardia with lithium when you're at higher doses. But, I mean, you're going to see if there's a history of that already or what someone else is on and whatever. But it's a very, very safe drug for the long term. And it's cheap, too. So that's a good thing for patient consumers to be able to stay on something that they can actually afford. It only costs pennies, you know. Any other things? Yeah.
A very simple question.
Yeah.
A patient yesterday comes into the clinic and, you know, starts being more emotional than usually you would expect. So I do the PHQ writing scale.
Yeah.
And if she comes up to like 17, which is according to the scale, it's like moderately severe. So I just started transsexually. The patient asked me, how long do you, you know, do I have to be honest for the rest of my life? I said, most likely not, but how long? I mean, how? Because she obviously, like, I started her, you know, she's got a follow-up. She actually was referred to my side clinic because, but, you know, usually, like, when you were her primary, like, if I was about to follow this patient, I mean, how would I know, like, when, you know, she, like, when the medication would be stopped? I think it's, like, 6 months, that's what you learn. But, I mean, practically, like, how do you manage?
First off, I always like to really take a very good history. I mean, this is really with everybody. History is key to really doing good work and diagnostic work, okay? So you have to first be sure that someone really has depression, if there are any acute stressors or things that are going on, and if the stressors might be things that are going to go away with time. Like, I mean, someone could, you know, score 17 or whatever, but if it's something that's going to be fleeting, like in their life, that they're going through changes, they're moving or something like that,
right.
I don't know if, you know.
Like, I asked her about the stress in her life, and, you know, as she, it seemed that she had, like, a few months ago, she had vascular surgery, and then, you know, she was having ulcers and extreme pain, and, you know, that she was not really responding to the pain medication she was given, and she was pretty much getting, like, upset about it. She couldn't sleep because of that, and it was like a vicious cycle that's been going on for a couple of months.
Now, was she upset because she wasn't getting better, or she was upset because she's still in pain?
She was, like, I think both. I think she was, like, she was upset that she had to do take so many pain medications.
Right.
She knew they weren't, like, you know, she was taking like 5-8 tablets of NSAIDs a day, and she was aware of the fact that, no, that's not a good dose to take. But then she basically she felt helpless about the situation.
Okay. Yeah, because one of the biggest complicating factors with treating depression is whether there's a presence of pain and how well the pain is being managed. And if you have someone who's on, you know, 5 or whatever, how many tabs of a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, and they're still not doing better, then that should be the first priority, is to see what can you do about either getting a pain consult or adjusting the pain on your own in some way that you think is, like, safe. Because no one could really be happy if they're in pain. And so, you know, like, we'll get these consults, oh, I wish I was dead, and I want to die, you know, like that. Many times, this is just pain-related. And you could sort of know where they're coming from. If someone has severe untreated pain, or let's say not maximally treated pain, you know, they're on something, but it's not working. I mean, there's no, you know, you can understand why they're saying, oh, I wish I was dead, you know. get them, you know, pain-free for 2 days, and then ask them that question again and see if they're going to be talking like that. They probably won't, you know. The thing is, a lot of the SSRIs also do have some pain control activity also, probably because it blocks like ascending pathways in the sensory system. So if you have like not even so much neuropathic pain, but really any kind of pain that's in the extremities, whatever. It's probably going to help a little bit because the brain is not getting all the feedback that you're even getting the sensory feel of having pain, you know. So pain consultants a lot of times use things like Paxil as ways to augment the pain regimens. So they'll have it with an opiate or something like that. It probably helps it to work, you know, symbiotically. Yeah. What do you want to say?
So the TD caused by any psychiatric haldol is usually irreversible, right?
So most of the time. I mean, usually what you have to do is you have to, you know, see if you can lower the dose or do away with the dose and see if maybe the TD symptoms will go away. Generally with tardive dyskinesia, your symptoms get worse before they get better. So let's say you've been on a neuroleptic, you've been on, you know, I don't know, 600 of Thorazine a day, and you stop it, you're going to have, that's, if you haven't had any dyskinetic movements, and you stop it for whatever reason, you're going to probably start to see TD coming out. And then that might last for a couple of weeks, and then it's going to go away, if you're lucky. If it doesn't go away, then you got it, you know. Neurologists generally will prescribe vitamin E to help with TD. I mean, maybe it helps a little bit. Usually you can give like 800 international units a day, and that could help for movement disorders, and maybe in time it'll help.
Oh, what other muscles can be involved other than limbs?
Yeah, well, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about Diaz, because they were talking about this dysphagia with him, and that's what I was thinking. I mean, for all I know, this is that same guy who's on the neuroleptics, and they want to say he has a tremor and everything. You can have motility problems in the esophagus and the dysphonias and stuff as a result of neuroleptics. I mean, it's rare, but it's not like unheard of. I've definitely seen it at Hillside Hospital where I trained, and where they had a lot of studies going on with neuroleptics. So that was like a somewhat common thing you would come across. So if you're worried about someone having a dysphagia, whatever, first thing I'd ask you to do is probably do a motility study, and maybe doing EMG studies to see if there's some irregularities in terms of nerve conduction in those areas, and that could be related to tardive. You know. Any other questions about meds or things? So just to sum up, we got 2 minutes. Biggest thing that I could tell you to do is always try to go back to the roots of where the person's coming from, and try to get from whatever history you can from whatever sources are around to see what has been going on with them, what meds they've been on, because that really is the best way to ensure that you're not going to have problems during the course of their hospital stays, at least in terms of management, and to make sure that people don't decompensate and that you have other problems. Okay, thanks.